passed away, all people wanted to see who would be the next source of emulation. We, the students of Imam Khomeini, had decided to glorify him at the funeral procession of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi to imply that the majority of the seminary students were advocates of him being a source of emulation. Thus, we were seeking to gather around him wherever he went during the ceremony and express our obedience and love to the Imam with reciting salawat. This way, we wanted to introduce him to the people, but we couldn't find him after a lot of searching. Imam Khomeini said later on, "I didn't come to the funeral procession of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi not because my health was so poor, but my refusal was because I realized that participation in the funeral had consequences and there would be raised issues in the ceremony. So I decided not to go there. Anyone who likes me, let that liking be in his heart. Let no one take a single step for me to become a chief." Another tradition for introducing a source of emulation in the seminaries was to hold mourning ceremonies for the deceased source of emulation. However, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, refused to do this as well. The Imam's younger son, late Haji Ahmad Agha Khomeini, said, "In summers, the Imam used to come to Imamzade Qasim in Tehran with his family. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, some of the ulama or religious scholars came to Imam Khomeini from Qom and insisted that he had to hold mourning ceremony. But the Imam said, 'I will neither hold the ceremony nor will I take part in it, because these things mean to raise the issue of a source of emulation.' I remember that even Mr. Eshraqi, the Imam's son-in-law, came and said the same thing to him, but the Imam did not accept." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had emphatically told his students not to mention his name in the gatherings and circles. Later, Ayatollah Abul Qasim Khazali mentions a memory, an anecdote in this regard. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, people flocked to Qom from everywhere in Iran to mark him. The night that I was supposed to deliver a speech, I came to the late Imam Khomeini and asked him to tell me something. He said, "What is necessary to be said is the unity of the seminary. The unity of the seminary should be preserved. Let there be no name and hint of me." Martyred Ayatollah Mahallati, in this regard, said, "One day I took some money and I had taken as khums to the Imam Khomeini and gave it to him. The Imam advised me and said, 'Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi has passed away. Don't think that he was our sustainer, or Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi was our sustainer. Our sustainer is God Almighty. You should preserve the dignity of religious scholars and ulama so that people may not think that clerics are needy. Preserve the dignity of the religious scholars. You should not say the smallest phrase that implies the deficiency of religious scholars or ulama. You don't have the right to say anything to imply that you are forging a source of emulation, to say a word in my support or backbite another. You should do your duty properly to serve the people and the struggle." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, considered the unity and coherence of seminaries as very important. In this regard, Hujjatul Islam Ali Akbar Mas'udi says, "When Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi passed away, the Imam was very sad, but he didn't take part neither in the funeral procession nor in the mourning ceremonies for the Grand Ayatollah. When he was asked about the reason, he said, "I think that perhaps my coming to the funeral and the memorial ceremony will divide the ranks of students. I don't want this division. I don't want this discrepancy. The great religious scholars or ulama should be in one rank too." Finally, Imam Khomeini held the ceremony to avoid the possible rumors that he was opposed to Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. Hujjat al-Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murtazavi Langerudi mentions an anecdote in this regard. He says, "Imam Khomeini waited for all great religious scholars or ulama to hold memorial ceremonies for Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, and then he held such a ceremony himself." Dear listeners, as you see, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, attached priority to unity and solidarity of seminaries. Thus, when he realized that his refusal to hold a ceremony for Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi might undermine the unity of the seminary, he accepted to do it. Yet, even in the ceremony, he became upset when the preacher mentioned his name as the cleric who had held the ceremony. Late Ayatollah Rizwani says in this regard, "When the Imam entered the ceremony, the preacher mentioned his name and said that the ceremony had been held on behalf of the Imam. Upon hearing his voice, the Imam summoned him and protested to him. He said, 'Till the end of this ceremony, you are not allowed to mention my name again.'"
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S., violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitement of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups will often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. Five people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. When you look at the numbers of people who were rioters, who worked their way into the Capitol, this is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists. We saw racist groups. We saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened to the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warrant his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the vice president and the cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment, but the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That too is politically complicated and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the U.S. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major U.S. towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the US government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognising when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a new US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, I points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counter-terrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos, expose internal collapse in the American political system, and that the event showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, and we profess to be the bastion of democracy, but the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years. But that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. The Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, the Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given into any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor Jared Kushner said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is and as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about some of the Islamic laws hovering around marriage or marriage-related questions, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
You know, we all know that, part of the entertainment that people have is watching movies or listening to the radios. So whether they watch it online or offline or through television channels, they like to entertain themselves at their leisure time. And we also know that most of the movies which are made or produced, in fact, do not come from the Muslim countries. So some of them are basically produced and directed in countries where there are non-Muslims involved, and that's why some of the men and women are naked or half-naked in it. Well, what is the Islamic law, Sheikh Javid, on this, according to Ayatollah Sistani? Is it permissible to watch such partial naked movies or with actors playing a part in it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it's absolutely forbidden for men and women to watch movies with women acting or playing without proper clothing.
Mm-hmm.
You just said the word naked. You used the term naked. There is no doubt about the prohibition of watching movies with women, with nude women. Of course, these movies are called pornography.
Yes,
I suppose, and it's absolutely forbidden to watch porn movies. There's no doubt about it, and of course, all these scholars are agreeable. There's a consensus about the prohibition of such movies. But okay, there are some movies. There mm-hmm. are some movies with women not wearing hijab. They are, for example, partially naked. Their legs are, to some extent, exposed to the viewers. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is permissible to watch these movies without lust, without having the intention to drive any pleasure. Okay?
I see.
If a person watches these movies with the sole intention of driving pleasure or with lustful intention, of course, it's not permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. If lust, if driving pleasure is involved, it's not permissible to watch these movies as an obligatory precaution. Ayatollah Sistani actually exercises precaution in this regard. Okay.
And no difference between males and females?
Of course, there's no difference as long as this, if a person watches, whether man or woman, watches these movies, these partially naked movies, okay? Mm. Just like regular American videos, movies,
yes.
Okay? Or European movies, it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution to watch these movies. If there's no fear of falling into a sin, and there's no such intention as driving pleasure, or there's no lustful intention, there's no problem in watching these movies.
Mm-hmm. What about real life? Like when you live in the West, you see even sometimes partially naked women walking around the streets.
Yes.
And what about that?
Of course, you as a citizen of that country, you have the right to walk in the roads. You cannot, you see, turn. You cannot actually keep your eyes shut.
Exactly. Unless you're going to run into another car or person and have an accident.
There's no problem in seeing these women walking in this. There's no problem in seeing these women with proper or improper clothing, as long as one does not look at them or stare at them or mm-hmm. gaze at them
mm-hmm.
with lustful intention. The ruling Grand Ayatollah Sistani issues is largely dependent on one's intention. And of course, it depends on the intention, whether something is going to be haram or something is going to be halal. If your intention is to look at a woman walking in front of you or coming towards you with lustful intention, it's not permissible to look at her. But seeing her, there is no problem, because you have to see. You just as you see the cars, the traffic rolling, and the people walking, you can see women also walking. And if you have no lustful intention, there is no problem.
Mm-hmm, I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What if some couples are having trouble having intimacy with each other, you know? And sometimes they are even advised by psychologists, for example, to watch such movies, even with the element of the lust. Not because of the lust per se, but because they want to have an intimacy or an intercourse with each other in their marital life. So basically, some of these people are recommended or advised to watch such content movies, adult movies, you know?
You're right.
Yeah. Is it permissible for couples, according to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani?
Well, that's a very good question. Ayatollah Sistani says it's not permissible for a couple, whatever the excuse, okay? Mm-hmm. Even if the husband has problem having intimacy or sexual intercourse with his wife, it's not a license for the husband to play this video before having sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there should be other actually cure, or there should be some kind of treatment for this, and the couple should consult a specialist, an expert, for any medication or any treatment. Okay, available. So it's not permissible for the couple to play such movies or to watch porn in order to for the husband to be sexually aroused and then have sexual intercourse. That's not permissible.
Oh, that's not permissible.
Sure.
I see. Sheikh, what about a scenario where there are trips or journeys involved on the part of the man and we know that sometimes they have to go on business, people are working,
sure.
And then they like to travel abroad, for business. So if they somehow stay far away from each other, I mean, a husband and his wife, is it possible, does this give a kind of permissibility to the couple to see each other naked online, for example, in order to please each other in this scenario?
That's also one of the most frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked online, provided that it is safe, and they are confident that it's the video is not going to be, let's say,
released
to other people or
yes.
seen by other people, or there is no such thing as cookies remaining in the computer or maybe on the laptop, allowing other people to see it. Okay,
mm-hmm. And so they have to make sure,
yeah.
even within the video, not
sure.
to be recorded.
Of course. There should be an arrangement for that. The two parties should make sure that no one else is going to see their video.
Yes.
And in this case, it is permissible for the husband and his wife to see each other naked. But you know, there's one thing that the two parties should know, and that is they cannot start touching their, for example, private parts to arouse, to help the other party get sexually aroused.
Yes.
Okay, that's absolutely not permissible, because self-gratification, self-stimulation
mm-hmm.
is absolutely forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no matter what the pretext or what the excuse.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun majaa ilaha illahum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basir
say that he does have ties to Muslim extremists? I don't know.
French citizens fear that France is becoming a police state. They believe that the regime in Paris wants to limit their freedoms. France has been the scene of social violence recently. People in France are protesting against a draft controversial security law. The legislation, known as the Global Security Bill, restricts filming on duty police officers. Article 24 of the proposed bill makes it a criminal offence to publish images of on-duty police officers with the intent to harm their physical or psychological integrity. It says offenders could face up to a year in prison and be fined 45,000 euros. Protesters describe the bill as France's way of curbing freedoms while preaching their importance to others. According to France's police watchdog, the IPGN, there were almost 1,500 complaints against officers last year, half of them for alleged violence. The timing of this bill couldn't be worse. It was voted right after a video was circulating online of the brutal arrest of a black music producer for not wearing a mask. The United Nations Human Rights Chief also urged France to withdraw a controversial part of its global security bill that would curb the freedom to share images identifying police. There's much truth to this statement. In France, it seems that racism and hatred against minorities and people of color is historic. France was a colonialist empire. The first colonial empire in France began in 1534, and the second colonial empire began in 1830. For example, Bordeaux was France's second largest slave port and prospered off the lucrative trade, deporting 150,000 African slaves to the Americans from 1672 to 1837 and providing Europe with goods such as cocoa, sugar and cotton. These historic realities are not mentioned on the banners. The new sign for the statue of slave trader David Gradis, who lived from 1665 to 1751 in the French city of Bordeaux, explains that he had 10 slave ships and provided a plot of land that became the city's first Jewish cemetery. It says nothing about his slave deals with American settlers. Another controversial statue is that of deceased colonizer Louis Faidherbe in the northern city of Lille, France. In the decades following the French Revolution and Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo back in 1815, a new movement called Romanticism began to flourish in France. France, through many liberal and social movements, tried to paint a different picture of its past. But even the French president recently emphasized that France is the same as it always was and won't change its past. But racism is not the only problem in France. Recently, there has been a spike of Islamophobia there. After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking another round of popular protests against it too. France guarantees the freedom of religion by virtue of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. The Republic is based on the principle of laicity, that is, a freedom of religion enforced by Jules Ferry laws and the 1905 Law on the Separation of the State and the Church. Paris has traditionally been associated with alternative artistic or intellectual subcultures, many of which involved foreigners. But it seems that things have changed in France, especially with the rise of Muslim immigrants there and across Europe. France's Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. Paris has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation and Muslims. The bill comes after outrage in the aftermath of a measure by French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which reprinted offensive caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in October of 2020. Charlie Hebdo's measure drew strong criticism from Muslims in France and Muslim countries, who called it an Islamophobic act, despite which French President Emmanuel Macron refused to condemn the measure, citing freedom of expression and claiming that it was not right for a political leader to get involved in editorial matters. The cartoons were originally published by the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten in 2005 and then republished by Charlie Hebdo in 2006. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims. The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money. In 1990, riots are triggered after two North Africans are shot dead. Also that same year, thousands of people commemorate killing of 17-year-old Moroccan in a racist incident. In 1991, police clash with French Arabs and North Africans. In 1992, tens of thousands of protesters take to the streets to demand change against racism. In 1993, the government approves a draft law to reinstate key provisions of its immigration law declared unconstitutional a month earlier. In 1997, thousands of protesters demonstrated across France against proposed legislation that would further tighten immigration controls. Minorities in France, whether people of color or Muslims, believe that the situation nowadays has got even worse. With the rise of police brutality against blacks and the rise in Islamophobia, supported directly by the state, they're going to have to live with new realities in a nation that has long preached human rights values and democracy while covering up its controversial racist and colonialist past.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Qalb Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
شدن بر اصحابشون بعد خطاب کردن به اصحاب ارتعوا فی ریاض الجنه.
One day the holy prophet of Islam came to his companions and stated, attend the gardens in heaven. The companions asked, what are the gardens of heavens? Then the prophet answered, the sessions and gatherings in which I, the Prophet of Allah, am remembered. This is a garden in heaven. Now, one of the blessings for Shia community are the gatherings and sessions which are held in remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt. The sessions and majalis for Imam al-Hussein and other infallibles, or the sessions during the month of Ramadan, are all indications of remembrance of holy men of Allah, and as a result, Allah Himself. The Holy Prophet of Islam also asked his companions to attend the remembrance sessions of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt during all parts of the day and night, and whenever they find a chance. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Qalb Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Qalb Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.